It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Conner. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, whether you're there for the no-fee ATM, the cheap baked goods, or the clean bathrooms, many of us have made a stop in Quick Trip. We'll talk about how it's become one of the fastest-growing convenience store chains in the nation next.
First, despite a topsy-turvy stock market lately, there are signs that the economy is maintaining some strong momentum as we start a new year.
Just this morning, the Labor Department said U.S. workers added 312,000 jobs in December. The Wall Street Journal had been predicting about 176,000. That's the biggest jump since February.
In addition, hourly earnings are up 3.2% from December 2017, the biggest full-year gain in a decade.
The positive economic news is being credited with a surge in the stock market today. That uptick follows the worst December since 1931 and the worst calendar year since 2008.
So what's going on? Josh Zumbrun is a national economics correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Josh, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's talk about this jobs report. First of all, big picture looks like pretty good news, right?
Yeah, I mean, for the U.S. worker, you know, workers generally, we're still in a pretty good environment. There's been a lot of concern in the stock market, obviously, but it's been focused very extensively on what's happening internationally. You know, China's economy has been slowing down. Europe's economy has looked a little rocky. And so that's bad for companies that have big international operations. But here in the United States, the job market has continued to be pretty solid. And we saw that again in this morning's jobs report, which looked at kind of the full year of 2018, the final month, the December jobs report.
And we saw this big increase in December in jobs, 300 plus thousand, but the unemployment rate went up a little, which seems weird, but that's actually maybe more good news. More people are saying, yeah, I'm going to get back into the job market that month.
Yeah, one of the interesting trends we've seen over the past kind of 4 or 5 years is that there's been a lot of people who, you know, the unemployment rate is only defined as people who are actively looking for work and can't find it. That's the kind of official definition of unemployment. There's a lot of people who don't have jobs but aren't looking. You know, retired people are obviously the biggest category of that, but there's also students and there's also people who are maybe on disability or people who are stay-at-home parents. And what's happened is that as the economy has gotten better, more and more of those people have kind of said, you know what, I think I am going to get back in the job market. I'm going to look for a job. And so they, you know, maybe they're briefly unemployed and they find a job. So there's been more of that in recent years. And that could have been one of the things that was going on in December, that we're just seeing more people who had been kind of outside of the labor force deciding to get back into it.
You wrote a piece putting these new numbers in perspective for the last bunch of years, going back to around the Great Recession and I think just before that, and looking at bigger graphs, you know, the labor force participation rate going up, but it has not really recovered, right, since the Great Recession. A lot more people are sitting on the sidelines.
Yeah, that's right. And two things have kind of happened over that period. I mean, one is that the economy was pretty bad for a really long time. And so a lot of people, you know, they gave up one way or the other. They decided they were going to be, they were going to, you know, leave the job market and take care of family, or they decided they were going to, you know, things weren't working out, they were going to get on Social Security or get on disability, and they've stayed out. And the other thing that's happened over that time period is just the timing of the baby boomer generation. You know, 1946, World War II ends, and that's when this huge surge of the population is born. And over the past kind of 8-10 years, those people have started to hit retirement age. They've started to hit that age where they can get full Social Security. And so there's been a lot of people coming out of the overall labor force because of that. So you add those two trends together, and you've had a huge kind of downward drift in the share of the U.S. population that's trying to work. And so we're slowly seeing that reverse, but we're nowhere near what it looked like 10 years ago, or you know, at the turn of the century was when those numbers were kind of at their peak. And because of demographics, because of that aging of the baby boomer generation and more of them retiring, we're probably not going to get back to those kinds of levels that we saw around the year 2000.
Now, through the recovery from the Great Recession, slow and steady gains in employment, unemployment rate going down. But one of the big questions has been, when are wages going to start going up? Have we seen movement in the last couple of years?
Yeah, I mean, it's been slower than most people would have expected. Typically, when the unemployment rate is really low, you see better wage gains than we're seeing now. We are seeing it pick up. The wages increased about 3.2% over the past year. And I think, like you said in the intro, that's like the strongest year-end reading that we've seen in 11 or 12 years or something like that. So we are seeing things start to pick up. But if you look at the late 90s and even the mid-2000s, you would see periods you would see periods where the unemployment rate was maybe even a little higher than this, but wage gains were going at like 4% a year. And we're not getting back to that kind of environment with wages for some reason. And that's one of the big kind of mysteries that economists debate right now, is why are the wage gains a little weak, considering how low the unemployment rate is.
Josh Zumbrun is with us from the Wall Street Journal, looking at today's jobs report, putting those numbers into context, and looking at the economy as a whole. Josh, last month, the big economic story was this dip in the stock market, this rocky up and down. We've seen a jump, I think, 700-some points today. Now, the stock market is not the economy. I get that. But how can that kind of volatility on the stock market end up hurting jobs, hurting people who, even if they're not involved directly in the stock market?
There's a couple of different ways. I mean, one is just that people who have they have big investment portfolios, they see the big losses, they're just a little bit less confident about things. You know, maybe they're retired and they spend some of the money out of the earnings of their investment portfolio, and you know, suddenly that picture isn't looking as good, so they spend a little bit less, their confidence a little bit lower. So it can kind of hurt consumer spending in that way. You know, it can also be the case that companies see their stock prices go down and decide they have to, you know, they think they have to take action. They think they have to lay some people off or fix some lines of business. And so you can see those kinds of effects happen over time. I mean, clearly we didn't see that last month, but that's the kind of thing you typically see in these sort of cycles where there's a weak stock market, is eventually you start to see companies react. And then the third thing is that, you know, the international picture really has been pretty troubling. So a lot of businesses don't really do anything overseas. You think about healthcare, you think about education, you're talking about primarily U.S. businesses. But for, you know, factory workers who work for businesses that export internationally, that starts to be something that's really tough. And so, you know, it's great that the U.S. job market is doing pretty well, but if your overseas customers disappear, that can be pretty bad for a business that exports. And that's clearly one of the things that's been motivating the stock market. So, you know, there's a lot of factors there where you can see the negative market over time really start to weigh on the job market. But, you know, this report really showed, one of the reasons people are so heartened by it is this report showed that we're not seeing those kinds of effects really hit yet.
And one more big open question we'll be watching in 2019 is Jerome Powell, the Fed chairman, and what he does, what he and the Federal Reserve do when it comes to interest rates. They've bumped them up a few times lately. Looking long term, they're like ridiculously low still, right, by historical comparison. Are his hands tied in his ability to raise those rates to a more normal level?
Well, I think the main way his hands are tied is that he doesn't want to be responsible for, you know, choking off the economy. I mean, the goal that the Fed has always expressed is to kind of get to a more normal sort of environment, and their hope has always been you could get interest rates back to something that looked a little bit more like the interest rates we saw 12 years ago, and that you could do that without knocking the economy into a new recession. And, you know, one of the things we've seen over the past year is that as the Fed has raised rates, investors have gotten really nervous about that. There's a lot of people who are concerned that the Fed is going too far, that they're, you know, even though rates are still low on an absolute level, that even these small increases are creating problems. You see signs of that in the housing market, for example. People got so used to kind of 3.5% and 4% interest rates that once mortgage rates started to go up to 4.5% or 5%, people were like, oh, I don't know if I want to buy as much house anymore. And so, you know, so you've seen some housing markets have slowed down as a result of that. So there is reason to think that these higher rates do have an impact already. And so that's kind of the area in which he's boxed in a little bit. He would like to get rates more normal, but, you know, people got used to those really low rates, and now, even though a 4.5 or 5% mortgage, I mean, you think back 10 years ago and somebody said, or 20 years ago and somebody said, oh, you can have a 5% 30-year mortgage, you would have said, great. But, you know, if you've been in the housing market 5 years ago and someone told you that, you'd say, oh, what a bummer. So there's that shift in perspective that really kind of boxes him in a little bit.
As we wrap up, Josh, what's the next big piece of data, the next big story you're watching for now?
Well, you know, one of the interesting things is that the government is still shut down here in Washington, D.C., and these are government reports. So traditionally, some of the next big economic reports we'd be looking for would be, you know, there should have been an international trade report next Tuesday. There should have been a retail sales report next week. There should have been an overall report on the size of the economy for the fourth quarter. That should have been coming up later this month. For now, none of those reports, the department that puts those reports, is completely shut down. So none of those reports are coming. And so we're in a little bit, kind of the main thing we're watching is whether or not that government gets reopened so we get those reports. I mean, we're in a situation where if the government doesn't reopen, we're going to be missing a lot of the data that we usually use to interpret how the economy is doing. And I think it'll make a lot of people, you know, a little uneasy not to know what's going on, because this is clearly a little bit of an uncertain time.
Josh, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Josh Zumbrun is a national economics correspondent at the Wall Street Journal. We talked to them about the better-than-expected December jobs report and the state of the economy as a whole. The Wisconsin company Quick Trip is shaking up the convenience store market. It's hard to drive too far in the country or the city without running into one of their stores.
Their first location opened in Eau Claire in 1965. In the 80s, they opened their very first dairy plant and had 50 stores. In 2003, their famous Glazer donuts were introduced, and they built banana ripening rooms. In 2008, they opened a bottling plant, and in 2016, they opened their 500th location.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you a frequent visitor to Quick Trip? Have you seen them taking over the convenience market in your neck of the woods? Given the choice between them and a different convenience store, do you select one over the other, and why? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org.
Hart Posen is an associate professor of management at the University of Wisconsin School of Business. He's with us in studio to talk about the Quick Trip takeover. Hart, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Hart, there are currently 376 Quick Trips in Wisconsin, so that's up from 273 stores just 5 years ago. So it sounds like they're growing, expanding. They must be doing a few things right. Have you been watching what they've been doing?
Absolutely. I think they're a phenomenal Wisconsin success story, and they really are doing something quite different than most other firms in their industry.
Really? Really? What's some of the things that they're doing that that's different from other convenience stores?
Well, you know, imagine the problem you face when you're driving and you're going to get gas or going to a convenience store.
Right.
A lot of these stores are not particularly, not always, clean. Washrooms in particular, we all know that feeling.
Right, right.
They're not particularly well-stocked with a good selection, sometimes not the highest quality products. And this is a real challenge for most of them, because even though they might have the sign of a famous oil company up there, right, these are mostly mom-and-pop businesses. And so they don't have the scale to do it right. They don't have the scale to train management. They don't have the scale to buy effectively. They don't have the scale to produce effectively. They don't have the scale to distribute effectively. And Quick Trip has come along and really focused narrowly on solving these problems.
You know, one of the things that I've noticed just going into to plenty of the Quick Trips around Madison and the Madison community is, you're right, it isn't the stereotypical gas station where you have the big wooden piece on a key to use the bathroom.
Yes.
Or, you know, some round piece of wood that you use. You're right. You walk in there and you walk into, if you have used the bathroom, they're very, very clean. It's certainly a departure from some of the convenience stores we've been seeing.
That's right. And the selection of food, even produce to some extent, which,
yeah,
is not something you often see very much of. Fresh food, never mind fresh donuts, which many of us prefer. it's extremely well done, and there's an important reason for that, right? So these folks across Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Iowa run over 600 stores. They are way bigger than most of the mom-and-pop firms they compete with, and they're backward integrated. They own their own milk production facilities. They, yeah, do their own distribution with their own trucks, and they train their own management. And this makes one heck of a big difference, mm-hmm, in the storefront experience.
Sure. Hart Posen is an associate professor of management at the University of Wisconsin School of Business. We're talking about the Quick Trip takeover across the state of Wisconsin. Last year, Quick Trip bought over 330 PDQ stores in Milwaukee and Madison. They didn't have that many. Sorry about that. A 2016 article from Duluth News talks about the store's big expansion in the north. Why are we seeing such rapid growth for them right now?
You know, you're right. If you look at the growth numbers, you know, it starts in the mid-60s, and it's sort of this slow, nice upward slope. In the last few years, it's really been expanding because they finally got to the scale at which it makes sense to be backward integrated, to do their own distribution, to ensure stuff is on the shelves, to do their own milk production. If you're much smaller than they are, the economies of scale don't exist to do it. If you've got 3 stores or 30 stores,
right,
you don't have the scale to do it. Now, the important thing is that they're located all in this sort of three-state area, right? The same 500 or 600 stores spread across the U.S. wouldn't be feasible because they supply it out of one facility in La Crosse.
Oh, gotcha.
So they've been these folks are a fine example of what a good strategy is.
let's go to the phones. Let's go to Mark and Nina. Good afternoon, Mark. Welcome to Central Time. Hello.
Hello there. How are you?
Good. Good. How are you? You have a question for Hart.
Yeah, well, I have a couple of comments about Quick Trip. I know the founding family, the Zitlos, and the competitive advantage they have. You guys talk about product and clean restrooms and everything else. I get that. But the real competitive advantage they have is how they treat their employees with respect and with love. And that's what sets them apart and why Quick Trip's employees go the extra mile for everybody that comes in the store.
Thank you for the call, Mark. And one of the things Mark is alluding to and what you hear a lot is how Quick Trip and how management treats
yes.
their employees. They seem to have a very good reputation in that regard.
Yeah, oh, that's true. You know, they're on sort of, you know, they're often on these rankings rated to be one of the best employers in the state and, in fact, one of the best employers in the country. But, you know, there are two parts to that, right? One implication of their profit sharing and their benefits and the way they treat their employees is lower employee turnover. In fact, their employee turnover is probably less than half of the industry average. But I think the flip side is to have the most convenience stores are not making substantial profits. It's not a high profit business for a mom and pop convenience store or even a small chain, a family that owns 3 or 5 stores. These are not typically high profit businesses. It doesn't leave any funds left to pay well or provide benefits. So I don't. I fully agree. They certainly treat their employees well, and it certainly pays off. But it's only feasible because they're also doing the other part that allows them to outcompete their rivals and demonstrate the kind of profitability that can pay for those things.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to John in Appleton. Good afternoon, John. Welcome to Central Time. Hello.
Hi there. I actually avoid Quick Trip primarily because of the $20 million taxpayer subsidies that they received, because I don't like having state government picking and choosing, you know, winners and losers. That gives them a significant financial advantage over many of the mom and pops that, you know, there's no way they can compete against $20 million in tax credits.
John, thank you so much for the call. And as John alluded to, we've heard that a lot as well. An Appleton Piggly Wiggly grocery store owner cited Quick Trip as being one of the big competitors that led to them going out of business. Do you see Quick Trip's big growth being bad news for others, including restaurants or grocery stores and other convenience stores?
Yeah, you know, so two things. Let's. Yeah, John's absolutely right, right? After Foxconn, Quick Trip in 2017 was the next biggest capital investment made by a single firm in the state of Wisconsin. They were investing almost $300 million. And the caller is absolutely right. They got a significant tax break as a consequence. Now, we can talk about the merits of that. To be honest with you, at their size, annual revenue, it's a private company, but probably in the $5 billion range, $20 million is probably not driving performance differences, right? They are out competing grocery stores like Piggly Wiggly. vaguely mom and pop convenience stores because of the economies of scale they have from size that the mom and pop simply can't compete with. And to go back to the prior caller, Quick Trip can train managers, they can train employees, they can retain those employees, and that makes a heck of a big difference. So yeah, the caller is absolutely right, but I think ultimately that number is small relative to the advantage Quick Trip seems to have vis-a-vis the rivals.
Do you think, though, as consumers, that we should be worried that the company may be growing a little bit too big? And what does that mean for the future of convenience stores and other small grocers going forward? You were talking about Piggly Wiggly. What will that mean for others going forward, in your opinion?
Yeah, you know, the convenience store business, if we, as a strategy scholar, we look at something called industry concentration, what market share is tied up in how many firms. In some industries, the top four firms might control 50, 60, 70% of the market. In the convenience store gas station business, I don't have dollar numbers because they're a private company, but it looks like they control about 15% of the convenience store gas stations in Wisconsin. That puts them certainly in the lead by far, but concentration is still very, very low in this business. Right now, they're not beating their rivals because of market power or because of monopoly power. They're beating them because of efficiency differences. And you know, it is true that that a more efficient firm will push out less efficient firms. Right. But that's the way, you know, the market works.
In 30 seconds or less, can you predict or at least have some ideas to what Quick Trip's planning on doing in 2019?
Well, private company, so not much information. I will say that their model, built around the Eau Claire plant distribution facility, limits where they can grow, meaning they're not going to grow into Arizona. They need to be, otherwise they would have to put in a new distribution facility and build up scale in that market. So I think you'll continue to see their growth localized in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Iowa, and I'd expect more growth, to be honest with you.
Hart, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure.
Hart Posen is an associate professor of management, University of Wisconsin School of Business. He joined us in studio to talk about the fast-growing convenience store chain Quick Trip and how it's shaking up the convenience store market.
It's this week's edition of Food Friday. If you're feeling some of the winter blues, well, here's an idea. Maybe it's time to spice up your cooking with a little bit of Caribbean flair.
From fresh plantain dishes to grilled pineapple upside-down rum cake, our guest chefs take us on a tour of modern Caribbean cooking while reflecting on its history. In addition, they share the stories of the generations of women who made this unique cuisine possible.
Michelle and Suzanne Russo join us now. They're sisters, they're chefs, and they're the co-authors of the new book, Provisions, The Roots of Caribbean Cooking, 150 Vegetarian Recipes. Michelle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thank you. It's great to be here.
And Suzanne, welcome to the show.
Thank you. We're so excited to be on the show, all the way in Wisconsin.
Yes, it's a little cooler here than in Jamaica, I bet, right now. Michelle, let's start with the roots of Caribbean cooking. What are the sources that went into creating this amazing and really varied cuisine?
Interestingly, so what we have always grown up eating here in the Caribbean are what we call provisions, or ground provisions, or what we also call food. And for us growing up, you know, the sort of the starchy provisions were very much the mainstay of the diet. And as we got more involved in the business, from a more professional perspective, you know, outside of the childhood way that we ate and the memories of dishes that we ate, what we recognized was that these roots and these provisions were intrinsically entwined with the history and the heritage of the region and our sort of heritage as slavery built around, plantation societies built around the structure of slavery. And so for us, really, what we wanted to do when we started to dive into it was to look at, you know, the geopolitical aspect of that, the food side of it, but then also like the social side of it. And, you know, what we uncovered was that throughout the region, one thing that stood firm was that all islands ate the same ingredients, irrespective of how they were prepared. there was a common thread throughout all of the islands of the Caribbean, whether they were British or Spanish or Dutch or French, and that was that we all ate, you know, yam and cassava and plantain, and that we would have avocado, and we had the same tropical fruits, and that, but each island had its own unique way of preparing or consuming it. And so that kind of led us to really the basis of the premise of the book, which is that the ingredients themselves, as well as the people who prepared them, are really the essence of what the culinary landscape of the Caribbean is built around.
And Suzanne, one thing that you uncovered was the huge role of women in creating and maintaining this cuisine, including some of the two of you's own ancestors.
Yes. I don't know if we uncovered that, or I think we deducted that. I think what became very present with the discovery of this long maternal lineage in our own family of a culinary career, which was our great grandmother, which we didn't know, that she had been this very successful businesswoman, restaurant owner, and well-respected, doyenne of the culinary world in her time, which would have been the 20s and 30s of, post-colonial Jamaica, which was not even a time when women would have rarely even worked outside of the home, that there was this sort of connected circle that we were sort of completing that was, in a way, for us, unknown, but and to us was really by happenstance. We got into the food business, not sort of by design. We didn't go to culinary school. We just fell into it and started operating, or a cafe that led to a restaurant that led to us doing training. And we've always taken a very culturally and sort of historical focus to our approach of the cuisine. And I think by our own personal experience of just looking at who the cooks and the chefs were, how the cuisine evolved from slavery through colonialism into the modern day, that the women were always the ones who were the nurturers, were the nourishers, who were the cooks, who were the, not quite the chefs, because it was not, that was not considered obviously a very refined experience, because Caribbean food is best, experienced, especially back then, in homes or on the streets. And that these were really sort of the purveyors of these, rustic and refined delicacies, and that our own grandmother had played this role. And I think our personal narrative has was so connected to this that what we looked at was how they had been, really not recognized and sort of ignored by history, because the historians were all males and a lot of the planters were males. So there had never really been a female narrative, and very much the tradition would have been an oral one, recipes handed down from generation to generation, certainly obviously in slavery and post-slavery times when women were not even, couldn't even read, and that this had really become this really enduring legacy of both, love and memory and so much more than, anyone had taken the time to stop and notice. And so it is through that lens and through our own personal narrative of this female relative that we began sort of that journey into telling the story of the food of the region.
Michelle, I'm really curious. What do you like about this kind of food?
Interesting. I think what I like most about this kind of food is that it is it's food that speaks to the soul and to the spirit. Mm-hmm. It's the kind of food that it's simple in its preparation. It's really, really clean. I think it has like a heartiness to it, a natural sort of cleanliness to it. But it's very satisfying. And if you grew up anywhere around, the Caribbean or the South or many parts of the world, there's an aspect to the food that feels always like comfort food, even if it is that you're not consciously trying to make comfort food. So, you sit down in front of a plate of fresh, Bombay mango, which is a particular strain of mango that we get in Jamaica in mango season. And, you just take a scoop of that and, I would always dance and I would feel like so happy, inside. And I think that there is something about eating in a way that is so deeply connected to your roots that it really brings back, it's almost like it brings back a collective memory, and it brings back a sensation that you're not really sure is it tied to your childhood or to the comforts of growing up, but in some way it kind of nourishes you, it makes you feel good inside, it really makes you feel comforted. And for the most part, I would say across the region, Caribbean people leave the region, I think this food for them brings back so much. You know, it, the essence of the island is felt not just in the food. It's in the air. It's in the smell. It's in the breeze. It's in the sort of, you know, the sunlight, you know, through the dappled trees. Like, we grew up like that, and we grew up outdoors, and we eat outdoors, and we entertain outdoors. So for a lot of people, in particular myself, I think it brings back the nostalgia of childhood, and when despite hardship or despite difficult times, life was just simple and innocent and fun and joyful, and the little things like, you know, knocking the stick and kicking the kicking stones on the street were what life was about. You know, so I think that's for me, I think, the essence of what I love about eating this way.
Talking to Michelle and Suzanne Russo, their new book is Provisions, The Roots of Caribbean Cooking, 150 Vegetarian Recipes. Suzanne, why did you tackle vegetarian recipes in particular in the book?
Well, that was a combined effort, I think, between ourselves and our publisher, DeCapo. I think that, you know, for the most part, when we looked at the cuisine of the region historically, as a cuisine that came really out of, you know, slave foods, as we would have, they would have been called then, slaves were really allotted only a meager amount of protein, usually in the form of salted meat, salted herring, salted mackerel, salt fish, pork, and that would have been the main protein. So much of their diet would have consisted of the ingredients we include in the book, which would have been the ground provisions, yam, cassava, banana, plant, breadfruit, and lots of vegetables that they would have probably harvested themselves from their own kitchen gardens or from these provision grounds. And so we initially had a version of the book that included all of these salted meats, because that is very much a part of the common diet for many people here in the islands, that they still eat salt fish at breakfast or salt herring or mackerel, which of course are came across the Atlantic. They're not really indigenous to the region. And so the publisher, I think, felt it told a more powerful story, given that we were really looking at really very healthy and very diverse, nutritionally dense ingredients, and that it was a more modern take on the cuisine, and we didn't disagree, because for the most part, this would have been the bulk of the diet, and the salted proteins would have been a smaller minority role in their daily diet. And so it was very authentically true, even though that's not really, I think, understood. So fresh fish and fresh meat would have been reserved really for the planters or the people in the great house, not for the people that were working the plantation. And from that, obviously, the blending of both of those, the cuisine has evolved over centuries.
We're talking right now with Michelle and Suzanne Russo. They are sisters and chefs and the co-authors of the new book, Provisions, The Roots of Caribbean Cooking.
Coming up, we'll check out a recipe or two. We've got three of them online, by the way, at WPR.org/Food Friday. An amazing looking dessert, a great lentil dish, and a corn soup. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you given Caribbean cooking a whirl yourself? Is it part of your own food heritage? What are your favorite recipes? Or do you have a question for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You know, so post and find a link, by the way, to those recipes at the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. It's Food Friday, and we're talking with Michelle and Suzanne Russo. They are sisters, chefs, and the co-authors of the new book, Provisions, The Roots of Caribbean Cooking. We're learning more about Caribbean cuisine and getting a few recipes along the way.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us about your own adventures in Caribbean cooking and eating. What kinds of dishes do you make or like? Do you have a connection to this food heritage? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Find some recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. To your calls now. Pierre is with us in La Crosse. Pierre, hi.
So, yes, I was calling. I'm, hello?
Yeah, you're on the air,
hello?
Pierre. Go ahead. Pierre? We lost Pierre. Okay, let's get to a recipe then. Michelle, let's take a look at one of the three you've shared with us. This looks great. Lentil salad with feta, orange, and hazelnuts. Tell us a little bit about that recipe.
So it's really easy. It's essentially that you cook your lentils, and then you make a nice light vinaigrette, and then you toss it.
Now I think we're...
For a while.
Okay.
You're losing me?
Yep, we lost you for a second there. Keep going on the lentil recipe.
No.
Right. So, yeah, so the lentils, so you make a lovely citrus vinaigrette. It's very light. It's something that you can eat room temperature, or you can keep it in your fridge and have it chilled and just has a quick anytime snack. And then when you serve it, you top it with the feta and the nuts, and it presents really, really well. It can be tossed also with, you know, greens, or it can be served with rice alongside. It's a really versatile dish, and we love lentils. And in fact, in St. Kitts, which is one of the islands of the British West Indies, everybody knows about red beans and rice, or pigeon beans and rice. But in St. Kitts, their rice and beans is made with lentils. So for many people, you know, we don't think of lentils as a Caribbean item, but it is consumed in some of the islands as well.
Now, Michelle, you've got a recipe for creamy Trini corn soup. Now, I've had corn chowder in the past, and it's very good. But Michelle, what makes this soup different?
So this is a typical soup that they would eat in Trinidad. And in Trinidad and Tobago, when they make this soup, it's a dish that's served roadside. It's served, by vendors who sell it on the street. Oftentimes after a fete or a party, if you're late at night and you've had a little bit too much to drink, you would step out, and that would be the perfect sort of after-party snack. Eaten on the road. But what they have in it, typically in Trinidad, they would put a little bit of salt pork or salted beef in there. It has coconut. It has something called shadow benny, which is culantro, a herb that tastes a little bit like cilantro. And it is not typically blended in Trinidad, but we partly blend it, so it's a bit like a chowder for that. And then you have pieces of corn that have been cooked in this, like, very flavorful, very rich, very filling, almost like a stew, but soup that is actually one of my favorite soups of the Caribbean. It's so delicious.
Now, those both look great. Now, we've got a third recipe at WPR.org/Food Friday. And sometimes on these food conversations, there's a recipe, and I look at it and I think, why am I not eating this right now? Here's the one this time: grilled pineapple upside down rum cake. Suzanne, tell us about this one. It sounds fantastic.
Hi there. Well, so this one combines a few of our favorite things: rum cake, which I know everyone loves, and pineapple upside down cake. And this, I think, was inspired by a recipe that is Haitian, and it is, of course, we have obviously this region in particular, this for sugar producing islands, so we have fantastic rum, and we just decided, why not sort of combine both? I think we've seen this a version of this kind of recipe in a Haitian cookbook that came across our way. And we love rum cake, and we thought, why not just do a rum cake but make it an upside-down rum cake with pineapple? And we grilled the pineapple before, and then you douse everything with rum. And it's really very much a kind of old-school comfort type of food, type dessert. But it's made better, of course, if you serve it with really good coconut ice cream or really good vanilla ice cream. Or what we love to do is do a coconut milk kind of creme anglaise, which is almost like a whipped sort of like a pastry cream, but you use coconut milk, which gives you sort of all of the components of the flavors of the region, you know, coconut, the pineapples, the sugar, the rum, and everything together is just like just a delicious burst of flavor. It's fairly simple to do. It's not overly fancy, and I think for us, it epitomizes what, like, typically a Caribbean kind of food experience and dessert would be like. It's simple, it's homey, it's comfort, it's probably best eaten in someone's home, but all of it combined together is incredibly delicious.
And Suzanne, this recipe has me just grilling it on the stovetop on a skillet. Could I put the pineapple just on my backyard grill and then pop
absolutely
it onto this dish?
Yeah, absolutely, because that would make it actually better, because you'd then get, like, the true char. And, you know, the flavors of the grill, and it would get nice and charred. I mean, we would do both. It just depends on what's available, what's convenient, what's accessible, time of year, winter. For us, obviously, grilling is easy because we have good weather all the time. But I think for us, our recipes are always inspiration, not to be followed exactly to the T. So if you want to change a little tweak here or there and, you know, add something or try something else, by all means, you know, go for it. Because I think for us, you know, cooking is always an inspired experience where the recipes are sort of, you know, ideas for you to use exactly as you want, or to something, you know, try your own version of that.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Pierre back again from La Crosse. Pierre, thanks for calling back. Welcome to Central Time.
Oh, yes, this is Pierre.
Yes, Pierre, you have a question.
Oh, I just have a statement. I was going to say that you can't talk about Caribbean cuisine and not talk about rice and the spices and what you put in the spice. The spice is the most important piece of the whole cuisine.
Pierre, thank you so much for the call. Suzanne, can you talk a little bit about the spices and what makes it special in Jamaican cuisine?
I mean, I think what the common thread that I would say, having lived among, between Trinidad and Jamaica and traveled widely, is when I think when he says spices, he means all the different seasonings that we use. And a big part of the cuisine of this region, for sure, is identified by heavily seasoned, sometimes peppery, spicy food. Not every island uses pepper by any means. But I think one of the distinct sort of attributes of Caribbean cuisine is the marinating. I think all of our meats are marinated and marinated usually for a few hours at least before cooking, which helps to build that base layer of flavor as we then begin put it on the heat. And so in Jamaica, typically you would have marinate from whether it's chicken, for fish, for meat, and even if we're doing grilled vegetables, we use a lot of thyme, a lot of garlic, a lot of ginger. Obviously, Scotch bonnet is famous for here, so Scotch bonnet would be in there, scallion would be in there. And those would be, I think, the fundamental spices that we would start with. In some cases, we'd add something like pimento, which you guys call cloves, which obviously is a big part of the jerk pork and chicken experience. But for us, I think that's different in Trinidad. If you go to Trinidad, you'll have a lot more of some of those same ingredients, but you'd add to that shadow benny, which is a kind of form of like cilantro, a culantro is the Latin American sort of relative to cilantro, but that same flavor profile. In other islands, like in St. Lucia and some of those other smaller islands, the food is delicious, but it is not at all spicy, as in peppery. But I think that, you know, we marinate a lot, and we add seasonings in copious quantities to our cooking process. So even if we've marinated meat, in some of these as ingredients, once we begin to cook them, let's say we're doing a fricassee chicken, into the pot with the fricassee, once you've browned the chicken and put in the liquid and you're cooking it down, you would then add more thyme, more scallion, more Scotch bonnet. Some people would throw in a piece of ginger. And so all of those sort of, you know, spices and seasonings continue to build the flavor as the dish cooks, or if it goes on a grill or whatever. So, yes, I would absolutely agree that spices and seasonings are a big part of, you know, the definitive sort of experience of eating Caribbean food of any island, actually.
Michelle, do you have any personal favorite recipes that's in the book?
One of my absolute favorites, I have two, actually. One of my absolute favorites is there is a eggplant and plantain layered gratin. There's two, I'm obsessed with plantain, ripe plantain. So there's one where we layer cooked eggplant with ripe plantain with some tomato sauce and a little bit of bechamel or mayonnaise sauce and goat cheese, and we bake that. So it's almost like a lasagna / eggplant parmesan, but it has the plantain in there. Absolutely gorgeous. And then the other one is there is a gungu pea falafel. And so instead of taking gungu peas in Jamaica, or pigeon peas, which in Trinidad they use for their for various dishes over there, the pilau, for instance, in Jamaica we use it to make gungu peas and rice at Christmas time. But they grow freely fresh here, but they're also available dry. But so we take that and we make it into a ball like a falafel, and it's a recipe that we got from a lovely friend of ours who lives down in Trelawney, and we serve that with what we call a pineapple chow. And in Trinidad, they do a lot of pickles with fresh fruits and vegetables. So they take the ripe pineapple and they put hot pepper and, well, cilantro or shadow benny, but cilantro and lime, and kind of make it sort of hot, sweet, and spicy. And we serve that with the fried gungu pea falafels. That's also my second favorite.
Well, you two have left us really hungry here, Michelle and Suzanne. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Michelle and Suzanne Russo. They're sisters, chefs, and they're the co-authors of the new book we've been talking about. It's called Provisions, The Roots of Caribbean Cooking, 150 Vegetarian Recipes. Okay, you want to cook some of this stuff this weekend? Great. Invite me over. And to find some of those recipes, go to WPR.org/Food Friday. A reminder, here's what you'll find there. Lentil salad with feta, orange, and hazelnuts. Okay, good. Creamy Trini corn soup, like a Trinidad-style corn soup. And then the dessert, make sure I show up in time for this one, grilled pineapple upside-down rum cake. I'll eat this.
I'll be there for all of it.
We should have a contest here at WPR and just challenge everybody to make this on one day so we just can, like, eat all we want.
Yeah, that would be great.
And the winner will be me. because I'll keep eating it. Yeah. I don't know. I don't make a lot of cake. I might make this one. Would you try to make that cake?
I would absolutely make this cake. I love pineapple.
Pineapple rum cake, yeah. Yeah. What could go wrong? Find those recipes and a lot more at WPR.org/Food Friday. Here's a bit of trivia I didn't know about until earlier this afternoon. Today is National Trivia Day. Jarrell, are you into competitive trivia games at all?
I like trivia, and every once in a while, I haven't done this in a while, but every once in a while we get together a few friends and go out to some of the bars and do their trivia night.
Oh, yeah. I've never done one of those.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun. And one time we did this. There's an annual neighborhood. A friend of mine had an annual neighborhood trivia contest, and they had this big event, and we ended up winning. So I was really happy about that.
Now, do you have a division of labor on the team? Like somebody's the history person, somebody's the sports person, and so on.
I'm the sports, pop culture, and
music?
TV and music.
Know a lot of music
and
so
movie
far.
Stuff. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Now I'm pretty good at trivia, and that's not a bragging thing. I think my like brain has a lot of room for random facts that don't help me in life.
Yes.
But not a lot of room for like I've met this person 17 times and I don't remember their name. Like the trivia all crowds that out for me.
Yeah.
And that's not helpful in life.
No, I was once called by a good friend of mine the king of useless information. So
I've been called that by my wife. All right, perfect. All right. We should form a team, man.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Some folks from here and do some trivia.
We throw down the gauntlet. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.